From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 16th day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. Later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Andersons Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana, and the agricultural weather forecast with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. In today's agricultural news, Mr. Obama says the Senate's American Power Act would cost Americans 20 to 40 cents a day. USDA says it's going to buy about $14 million worth of chicken. And the UNFAO predicts the price of most agricultural commodities will be higher in the future. Dave Dickey will be along in a moment with these and many more ag news stories. And then in the second half hour of our program, we call that The Farming World, and you can hear it on many of these radio stations and always online at willag.org. We'll talk with the president of the Corn Refiners Association. She'll tell us all about the four F's of corn. That's food, feed, fuel, and fiber. And it all happens right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled up in Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon. Futures like this: nearby July wheat at 461 and a quarter, 9.5 higher. September at 476 and three quarters, up 9.25. And December wheat at 504 and a half for the soft red, 10.5 cents higher. Kansas July hard red at $4.90 and a half, up 12.25. In Chicago, July corn at 356 and a quarter, 2.5 higher. September at 365 and three quarters, up 2.75. And December, 377 and a quarter, 2.25 higher. The March contract at 390 and a quarter, up 2.25 for the day. And the May corn at 299 and a quarter, up 2.25. Soy complex now: July beans, 957 and three quarters, up 8.25. August at 944 and three quarters, 9.25 higher. September at 930, 10 cents higher. And November beans at 924 and a half, up 9. January of next year at 933.5, up 8.25. July bean meal futures up 13 at 287. Oil at 38.13, up 32. Live cattle at $90 and a nickel unchanged. August feeders at 110.90, down 7.5 cents. And July lean hogs at $80.90, 77.5 cents higher on the afternoon. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, $77.68 a barrel, up 74 cents. July ethanol at $1.61.7, a penny and 2 cents higher. Natural gas at $5.03, down 18.6 cents. And heating oil, or July contract there, diesel fuel at $2.11 and a tenth, up 4 and 2 tenths. Gold futures at $1,229.30, $3.90 higher. The Dow at $10,417. Just about 13 points higher, and the U.S. dollar at 86.09 is up 0.11 on the afternoon. The CRB index at 264.15, up 0.65 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast says. Isolated scattered showers will return Thursday into the weekend across the Midwest, but most of the resulting rainfall will be light and generally insignificant. A few stronger thunderstorms will be possible late Saturday into Sunday, that from Iowa all the way across to Ohio. Areas from Missouri to Kentucky and southern Ohio will see the least rainfall and will probably see the greatest net drying. Warm temperatures and high humidity should prevail throughout next week and even further out to 10 days. Daily highs in the 80s and 90s. Lows in the 60s and the 70s. The second week weather should generate additional potential for rain, with northern areas favored at first, and then some timely rain in the south. That, of course, from the dates of June the 23rd to June the 29th. And finally, crop development should be quite aggressive under these conditions. Some improved conditions for late planting and spraying are likely. More on the weather when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with Drew Lerner. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. It's a production of NPR and U of I.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, time to check the agricultural futures markets. And Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois is with us. Good afternoon to you. How are you, Paul?
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, let's talk about the marketplace. What was it concerned primarily with today?
Well, it was focusing on two areas, some demand, wheat demand to Saudi Arabia, a crop that's in trouble in Canada with smaller acreage planted in wheat, canola, oats. Oats continue to be a background. And, of course, there was some background news in beans with China buying beans. Of course, we have about 1.5 million beans yet to plant. In the corn area, we have still corn to be planted or replanted, and the problem is that the south and southeast part of the United States, about 4.5 million acres, are going to see an extended period of time of 90-plus degree temperatures, and also about 8 million acres of soybeans are going to see some extended heat. And my contention is the crop is, when we ask ourselves the question this morning, is the crop getting bigger or smaller? I'd say probably smaller this coming week. And at the same time, there's some problems as far as planting the rest of the crop. And three, maybe we are starting to see some indications that the total supply in the world is maybe not as good as it was a week ago.
And this is for the soy complex and beans in particular?
The whole gamut of the crop, corn, soybeans, and wheat.
For across the board.
We've had a lot of rain in central Illinois. We've got, as I mentioned, 4.5 million acres of corn that's going to go through some very hot conditions. We still have some wet weather coming up, but then also some warmer conditions after that.
Who will be the buyers?
Who will be the buyers? Mm. Well, with the crop getting smaller, that's a plus in the marketplace. The second plus in the marketplace is the commodity players are quite short. And the third one is that a couple of weeks ago when the government came out with the supply-demand, you know, the ethanol took some of the carryover away. And I think on the planted intentions report, we'll probably see probably 1 million acres less corn due to the Dakotas and late planting up there. And, of course, we could see some more bean acres, but as we all know from past experiences, getting beans planted after June, probably the 21st or 25th, have a tendency to have a come in with a very strong yield of 32 to 35 bushels per acre.
Okay, if we're shorter this week than we were last, what can you see the market doing? So we've got December corn at what on this afternoon we finished up. That contract at 377.25, how much higher than that? And November beans at 924.5, how much higher than that?
Well, there's also another little rule is that when you do see 90-degree temperatures to 95-degree temperatures in some of our growing areas, it does have a tendency to scare the market a little bit. I think that what it boils down to is that we could see 20 cents up in the beans in the next 10 days to 2 weeks, and possibly a dime up in the corn market in the next 2 weeks if we continue to see Mother Nature being a little unruly, people still covering short positions, maybe some stability in the U.S. economy. Those are the main areas, I think, of thing. Also, we can bring up that if we do come in with a 2% mandate of blending corn into ethanol, it would increase corn usage in the United States 500 million bushels, and that would also be a help to the bottom line of the Midwest corn farmer. Even last night, and it was brought to me by several farmers calling in today, that We didn't hear one word last night used about renewable energy, renewable cornfields in the state of Illinois using corn. And, you know, that's a big political and an economic boost for the Midwest.
All right. We did hear about wind energy, but not about
them. We raise a lot of that on a daily basis.
Yeah. Well, Illinois is one of those places where that's a wind tunnel, and it makes some sense. Any other things that we had to talk about before I let you go?
Have a profitable day.
You too. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report that happens each and every Wednesday afternoon.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson. Since 1985, offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Have you visited our website recently? Maybe you ought to if you haven't. The address is willag.org. There you'll find all of our daily ag programming from the pre-opening to the closing market reports, Commodity Week, which is our premier program for the weekend, and the farming world. That comes up later in the half hour on some of these radio stations. It's all at willag.org in its entirety for you to listen to anytime you'd like. Just visit the website. Don't forget to sign up for our free weekend newsletter while you're there as well. Now here's Dave with today's agriculture.
In agricultural news, the Obama administration says today that a climate and energy bill being pushed in the Senate would cost American households 22 to 40 cents a day. The bill, dubbed the American Power Act, aims to cut emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping greenhouse gases by 17% by 2020 and by more than 80% by 2050. The bill would, for the first time, set a price on carbon emissions produced by coal-fired power plants and other large polluters. USDA says it plans to buy as much as $14 million worth of dark meat chicken products to help producers facing a glut in stocks and decreasing prices. The U.S. chicken industry lost its top export market for dark chicken meat in January when Russia blocked imports due to concerns about a routine chlorine wash used by U.S. processors. USDA reported that there were 90.59 million pounds of dark meat chicken leg quarters in storage as of April 30th. That's a 21% increase from a year ago. The government purchase will be used by food banks, school lunch programs, and other food assistance programs. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization today says that agricultural prices in 2010 to 2019 will be mostly higher than in the decade preceding a spike in 2007-2008, bolstered by an economic recovery and rising energy prices. Crop and livestock products, with the exception of pork, are all expected to show higher real prices in the coming decade versus 1997 through 2006, with wheat and coarse grains seen 15 to 40% higher and vegetable oils up more than 40%. Rising crude oil, seen at over $96 a barrel in 2019, would support agricultural prices by raising input costs and boosting markets for biofuels that use crops. NOAA's National Climate Data Center today says that last month was the warmest May on record. In addition to a record hot May, high temperature surface records for warmth on the planet's land and oceans were set for the period of March through May and for January through May. The global land surface temperature for May was 53.87 degrees, which is 1.87 degrees above the 20th century average. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, you know, the budget crises around the nation are forcing land-grant universities to reconsider their threefold mission of teaching, research, and outreach. I'll have more on how one man thinks it might all unfold for commercial agriculture. Extension services are funded largely by federal, state, and local tax dollars. Usually these organizations are the educational outreach function of the state land-grant university system. That's the case in Illinois, where Mike Gray has lived and worked as an extension entomologist serving commercial farmers for most of his career. He has extension counterparts in most of the surrounding states that do a similar function, but says dwindling dollars may eventually force those state lines to fall for his and many other functions of extension that service commercial agriculture.
Whether it's agronomy, plant pathology, weed science, entomology, soil fertility, all of those kind of areas that we have seen reductions, not just in our state, but in other land grants in terms of fewer positions in some of those areas. We are getting down to just small cores of those people. And increasingly, we're going to have to look at ways to share resources, not just across regional lines within states, but across state lines.
Gray says one of the other things that has happened over the last couple of decades, beyond the degrading financial resources that's allowing a contraction in the number of extension professionals, is pretty simple. Commercial farmers, Gray says, go first to the certified crop advisor for information.
And in many cases, it's very good information. But your larger scale commercial producer, in many cases, does go back to that land grant and say, can you send me a copy of your trials, you know, the results from your experiments? What do you think of this recommendation? Is this recommendation right on? So we do get a lot of those kind of requests. But in that sense, that information has been funneled back directly to that campus-based specialist. And as you know, we're not seeing as many requests coming in from large-scale corn and soybean producers directly to that small office because commercial agriculture is so specialized.
So Mike Gray says it seems to make sense to increase, at least in the state of Illinois, the applied research presence in commercial agriculture and, in the process, the overall visibility of the land grant in the agricultural industry. The land grant is a check and a balance for the food, fiber, feed, and renewable fuel system.
We provide a check and balance to the system. That's correct. But we have to be research-based. And that is a very important role. Where is that research coming from? And with electronic technologies, whether it's Twitter, email, you know, access to our electronic bulletin, you know, growers can go directly to specialists very easily anymore. And in many cases, we'll request PDF versions of peer-reviewed journal articles. So it's a very sophisticated audience.
Extension is changing in Illinois and the nation. Communication from the professional to the farmer is setting a primary parameter on which the revised, streamlined delivery system will be built. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You know, there is one other way that you can get the information that comes to you from agriculture at Illinois Public Media, willag.org, beyond the website. You can call this phone number. It's 217-333-3434. We post a bit of the analysis segment, neither the pre-opening, rather the opening or the closing market reports there, at about 10:15 and 3:15 each and every business day of the year. That phone number again is 217-333-3434. It's time now to check the agricultural cash grain market. Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana, is on the phone line. Good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Beautiful day here. Farmers busy trying to do some catch up and replant and maybe plant some soybeans and spray and all those kinds of things?
Yeah, all the above here. I think this is our first day that we haven't had rain, at least part of the day, for it seems like 2 weeks now. So.
Oh, I suppose they actually have a spade and they're out draining spots in the field as opposed to anything else, don't they? Yeah, a little dirt work. That never hurt anybody too much.
All right.
So tell me about the cash grain market in your area.
You know, with this recent rally here on corn, it seems like the producer is willing to move corn. You know, it's evident looking out my window when here at Climbers Ethanol we have, probably going on pace to dump 250-plus trucks today. Did dump 250 trucks yesterday. It's been some time since we've had that kind of pace here. So corn's wanting to move here. Basis is steady to just a touch firmer as everybody wants to get in front of this corn movement and at least get the first half of the corn movement and, before basis breaks here.
Were you surprised that farmers were willing to let go and movement took off?
You know, not really. We knew the corn was out there. It's one of two things that was going to incur movement, either the clock or the calendar, I should say, or the board. And since both of them are kind of stacked against the producer at this point, any type of rally here, we've been advising producers to get some corn moved, and I think some guys are taking us up on that.
Are they doing new crop too?
You know, not a lot of new crop. Actually, more than anything, D11 is where we've seen guys do some business here. 410 futures has been a popular number that guys want to get something done and did get something done on that today. So more in the deferreds than actually what's in the ground right now.
Oh, wow. So you're able to go that far out now?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, wow. So, and you've got a few taking advantage of that. That surprises me, but I'm surprised that they were thinking that far out, frankly. But well, now you made me think about the beans. What are they doing there?
Beans have been pretty quiet. There's really not a lot of beans left in the countryside. The ones that are left probably won $15 for them, it seems like. I thought $10 would incur some bean movement for the last little bit. And it has a little bit here, but not as much as I thought. And they talk to the guys who have beans. They're bowled up on bean basis. Old beans are pretty much quiet. New beans, guys really haven't done a lot there either, and definitely not in the Novi 11 or anything in the deferreds.
All right, and then finally, what are your bids for the day?
Yeah, Climbers Corns ends at 356, Delphi Beans 933.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
And that is Matt Blaisdell. He's with the Anderson's Climbers facility right here. He's with Matt at the Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana, not the one that's in Champaign County. And he joins us each and every Wednesday afternoon to take a look at the agricultural futures markets and cash grain in his area. Stay with us this afternoon in just a few moments. We'll talk with Drew Lerner Weather and World Weather out of Kansas City, Missouri, about the agricultural weather forecast.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
It's National Fudge Day. Many people think fudge is an American invention. It's believed that the first batch was a batch of caramels that went wrong, thus the name fudge. The first known sale of fudge was in 1886 in Baltimore. The cost was 40 cents a pound. On this day in agricultural history in 1794, the first stone was laid for the world's largest grain windmill in Holland. Known as the Whale, it is still in existence today. In 1855, John Gorey died. Gorey received the first U.S. patent for mechanical refrigeration in 1851. In 1893, Cracker Jack was introduced at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. By the way, the secret formula which prevents the molasses-coated popcorn from sticking together came 3 years later in 1896. A prize in every box was introduced in 1912, and Sailor Jack and Bingo made their first appearance on the box in 1918. In 1903, a one-year-old company registered its trade name Pepsi-Cola. The original name was Brad's Drink after Caleb Bradham, the pharmacist who developed the formula. Among the ingredients, carbonated water, sugar, vanilla, oils, pepsin, and cola nut extract. And in 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that patents could be issued for genetically engineered organisms. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. On the phone line, Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Thanks for being with us, Drew.
Thanks, Todd. I hope you're enjoying your day.
I am having a very good day. I hope you are too. And that's partly due because there's some sunshine out there today.
That's right. We are we're finally working our way out of this most recent bout of frequent rainfall across the region. And the good news is that we'll get a chance to dry out some areas that have had just a little bit too much moisture. I'm really kind of concerned about our wheat crop out there in the Midwest and part of the Central Plains. We really kind of beat those crops up a little bit in the past week with a little too much moisture and that wet weather disease issue and then the grain quality slipping a bit. And so we really need this little break that's underway here right now. I'm not totally convinced it's going to last forever, though. We need to be real careful about watching the weather here. It looks like we'll certainly benefit tremendously over the next week with a lessening of rainfall across many areas, especially in those southern parts of the Midwest. That's the region from maybe Kansas into the Ohio River Valley. That region will probably see the least amount of rainfall for a little while. And temperatures will be seasonally warm, and that should help to stimulate some aggressive crop development across the corn and soybean country. And we will also see a relatively improved weather pattern that might help to support some of the spraying needs that are out there in some of these fields. But we've got to firm them up first in order to get access to them. Anyway, the bottom line is I think we're going to be doing okay over this next week. In the second week of the two-week outlook, there's some potential for a return of cooler weather to the north. And if that indeed does evolve, that will push the frontal boundaries back into the heart of the Midwest again, and we may see another round of frequent rainfall across the area. So that's something we're watching for, but at the moment it's kind of speculative. So we'll see how that pans out in future computer forecast model runs.
What other growing regions around the globe are you watching?
Well, we continue to watch China real closely. In fact, I know the marketplace is really on the edge of their seats right now about that. There's some very significant dryness in their Yellow River Basin. It's kind of east central parts of the country. They irrigate an awful lot of crop in there, but there are some fields that are not irrigated, and they are stressed out right now. It's been a few weeks since it's rained decently across that region. Temperatures yesterday were about 100 degrees, so they're starting to experience a little bit of stress that is a little more threatening to the production potential there. What's interesting is that that part of China often turns a little bit dry during a La Nina event that is evolving. And a little later in that same year, there's usually a shift to the northeast of that dryness, and that could impact some of the key corn and soybean-producing areas in northeast China a little later this season. So everybody's really watching that closely since it looks like the U.S. crops are going to do so very well.
Drew, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Wednesday afternoon. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, stay with us for the farming world. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You do remember that this is publicly funded radio, and we do need your help. If you visit willag.org and then look up to the right-hand side of the page and hit willpledge.org, it would make a difference by the end of this month. This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll have a discussion with Audrey Erickson. She is the president of the Corn Refiners Association and located in Washington, D.C. Ms. Erickson, thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell me a bit about the Corn Refiners Association and what it might be?
Absolutely. The Corn Refiners Association represents the corn wet milling industry, and our members make many, many ingredients that American consumers enjoy and use every day in a myriad of products, everything from refined corn products found in foods and beverages, in industrial products, in pharmaceuticals, in the paper industry, everything from toothpaste to crayon. There's always a little bit of corn in many of the things that make life possible.
How's that possible?
And what we do is we refine the corn through a wet milling process, meaning that when the kernels enter our plants, of which there are approximately 24 plants across the country, they're steeped in water so that they expand somewhat like a sponge. And then we pull apart the component parts of the kernel and manufacture everything from corn oil to high fructose corn syrup to biodegradable plastics to ethanol. So, and the starches, of course, that we extract from the kernel itself for many uses.
And who are the members, and do they pay a fee to the association?
This is an association that will soon celebrate its 100th anniversary. And our members, there are seven members of the association, because as you can imagine, this is an industry that is very capital intensive and also has been around for a long time. So you have a lot of players that have been in the business for decades, many decades, some even over 100 years themselves. And all of them are listed on corn.org, which is our website.
And they would be, and I'm going to make some guesses very quickly, probably ADM and Bungie, I would suppose. Cargill?
Actually, I'll name them alphabetically for you. And
great.
It is Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill Incorporated, Corn Products International, National Starch, Penford Products, Roquette America, and Tate and Lyle.
Ah, so some that our listeners will be familiar with, of course, and some that our listeners are not. What's the difference between a wet mill and a dry mill? And maybe you can talk about the ethanol industry in that process.
Sure. Really, with respect to both, it's all about the process, about how you either, in the case of a dry mill, crush the corn in essence, or mill the corn, or in a wet mill where you are steeping it in water. You get far more products from a wet milling operation than from a dry mill. And dry mill, you know, there's the dry mills that make corn flour and corn meal, and then there's also the dry mills that make ethanol and dried distillers grains. On our side, for wet milling, you're making all the various corn starches, both modified and unmodified, the specialty starches. You're making corn sweeteners like high fructose corn syrup and corn syrup and fructose, so the fructose and glucose syrups. You're making PLA, polylactic acid, you know, which is the plastics. you're making the animal feed, which is corn gluten feed and corn gluten meal. So, and then a whole host of other products.
And so what do you do for these companies exactly? Do you lobby on behalf of them in Washington? Is that why you're located there?
Yes, we are located in Washington in part because we work closely with the administration, both the executive branch, but also the legislative branch, members of Congress, naturally, the House and the Senate. When there are issues affecting our industry, let's take, in the case when we are negotiating trade agreements with other countries, we're working hard with the administrative branch, for example, to ensure that our products are in the lowest tariff baskets. We're working with Congress to get the passage of those trade agreements, just as an example. We also work closely with the press and provide information to them about the products from our industry. And you may have heard, for example, we're working very hard on a public education campaign for our corn sweetener, high fructose corn syrup, essentially to correct the record in the public domain.
So you're up to those things at this point. You have 100 years of history. How did you come into being?
Really, it was an organization that started largely as an institute, had a primary function, many functions, but one of which way back when was research in the industry as new and innovative uses of corn were being developed. And over time, that has really changed to today, where research is conducted largely by our member companies themselves, and the job of the association is more along the lines of public information and advocacy.
Okay. Can you talk about one of the subjects I know that you're, I'm sure, well-versed with? This would be high fructose corn syrup. It's come under a lot of pressure for childhood obesity in recent years. What do the numbers look like, do you think, from the perspective of the producers of high fructose corn syrup, and how does it get incorporated into the food supply?
Well, high fructose corn syrup is a substitute for sugar. It's a type of sugar made from corn. It was introduced into the U.S. market widely in the late 70s, and by mid to late 80s became the sweetener of preference, if you will, for caloric soft drinks, and then branched into many, many food uses because of its characteristics, everything from retaining moisture in baked goods to bringing out fruit and spice flavors and marinades to aiding in fermentation of yogurt to having a lower freezing point. So when you have products that are stored in the freezer, when you pull them out, you know, they look like a strawberry, or when they're canned, for example, helping retain the firmness of that particular fruit or vegetable. It has a myriad of uses and is widely prized by the food and beverage industry, and as a result is about just under half the caloric sweetener use in America, with table sugar being the predominant use of caloric sweeteners. And there has been, just in recent years, a lot of misinformation about the product, largely because it has two words in its name, high and fructose, when in fact it's an ingredient that is neither of those. It's not high in fructose at all. In fact, it's very similar to table sugar or honey or maple syrup in that it contains almost equal parts of the two simple sugars, fructose and glucose. And at the same time that you have the issue of obesity being discussed as a public health issue, and then you have a lot of researchers who are trying to find the holy grail, gee, is there something unique, you know, that causes obesity when something else doesn't? Well, guess what? We always know the answer to that, and that is calories in and calories out remains the primary equation when it comes to overweight and obese conditions in America. And in fact, that issue, obesity and overweight conditions, is not immune to just the United States. It's not only here, but it's worldwide, yet this is a sweetener that is predominantly found only in the United States. Because corn is our primary starch source, and we grow it well here, obviously, whereas other countries have highly protected sugar industries, for example, and so sugar remains their primary caloric sweetener. So we've been working hard in our campaign to provide the science-based facts, because ultimately when consumers come to their diet and nutrition needs, they need to know what it is and what it ain't, as some people would say. They need to know the facts about the foods that they and their families eat. And so that's largely what our campaign is designed to do, is to provide information to consumers so that they can make sound dietary decisions.
And primarily, most people would think of this being used for colas and soft drinks in the United States. But if you travel out of the United States, you'll find that many of those are actually developed with sugar. Cane sugar, as opposed to that which would come from corn. Is this correct?
That is correct, and that is largely because of the sugar policies that many countries around the world have, whether they're protecting their own domestic supply or whether they are favoring, if you will, through agricultural policy, imports from countries that are lesser developed. As you know, sugar is grown in many countries around the world. The majority of countries that grow sugar are lesser developed or least developed nations. And so you have regions of the world like the European Union that have policies that favor trade with those countries. In the United States, we have both sugar produced domestically as well as the sweetener, the sugar from corn, high fructose corn syrup.
Now, in the United States, wouldn't you say that, maybe I'm wrong, that the agricultural policies of the United States favors high fructose corn sweeteners rather than sugar?
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you asked the question. It's a very good one. In fact, there are only really two sweeteners that benefit from the Farm Bill directly, and that would be sugar. You know, we have a policy in the United States which is limit imports, keep them at zero if possible. That's just the policy that's been adopted. And then for the domestic supply of sugar, that it's regulated. Its entire supply is regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in terms of which a refiner of sugar can put refined sugar on the market, whether it comes from beets, sugar beets, or sugar cane. Conversely, on the corn side of the equation, high fructose corn syrup is not in the Farm Bill. It is a highly competitive product produced by five manufacturers in the United States that compete in the U.S. market, not only against each other, but clearly against other caloric sweeteners in the marketplace, from honey to maple syrup to sugar to fruit juice concentrates, which are just stripped down to their sugar components. And policies in the Farm Bill, which, you know, affect row crops and attempt to support their price, if you will. In the case of corn, that's not been needed in the past several years because demand for corn has been robust and the price of corn has been strong, historically above average in these most recent years.
Yeah, but it's the policy for sugar that helps out the corn refiners and allows fructose to continue to be used. In part, I suppose, in the production of soft drinks?
Well, actually, that's a great question. And when it comes to the policies of sugar, clearly, you know, there is a policy in the United States. The net effect of the policy in the United States is to maintain a very high price for sugar, but it's the sugar industry that doesn't want competition. But yet, when it comes to high fructose corn syrup, the pricing of our ingredient is delinked. Has been for, what, two decades now from sugar. When we first introduced this ingredient into the marketplace, it was the case that it was essentially priced, if you will, at some discount to sugar. That once we supplied 100% of the caloric needs for, you know, full-calorie soft drinks, that price delinkage began, in essence, and it has accelerated through time, and a lot of the data would demonstrate that. But yet, what really drives the demand for high fructose corn syrup is its functionality. And by that I mean in the case of soft drinks, when you put it in a pH environment like a soft drink, it won't change its taste profile over time. It will remain intact. Unlike sugar, which the two simple sugars will slowly separate, and as that happens, it would change its taste profile, which, as you know, for these branded beverages, that is something that is not tolerable. Also, this is a sweetener that's provided in liquid form, easy to blend. And because of where we taste on the tongue, it won't mask certain flavors. So if you have a lemon-lime beverage, for example, you're going to enhance those lemon-lime flavors rather than mask them, which sugar can tend to do. But these functional benefits are really pervasive throughout the many uses of high fructose corn syrup, whether it's in yogurts or breads or cereals or crackers or salad dressings or spaghetti sauce or condiments, you name it, of the many uses in which we find high fructose corn syrup. What really drives the demand for this ingredient is those functional benefits that make many of these foods possible that we consumers, you know, take for granted but enjoy on a daily basis.
We're talking today with Audrey Erickson. She's the president of the Corn Refiners Association. You're listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the top economist of the International Monetary Fund says that It is in China's interest to revalue its currency. Oliver Blanchard says, quote, some sectors in China are overheating and workers are demanding more pay. Authorities don't want the inflation risk to grow. France government officials today say that the French will have to work 2 years longer before retiring, and the rich will pay higher taxes in an effort to drag France's pensions budget out of the red. Under the plan, which is likely to meet stiff trade union resistance, the minimum retirement age will be lifted gradually to 62 in 2018 from 60 at present. Even with the change, France will still have one of the earliest legal retirement ages in the developed world. Germany plans to raise its retirement age to 67, while Britain and Italy are standardizing at 65. Bill Davidson, CEO of the Regional Agricultural Cooperative Growmark, is announcing his retirement as soon as possible after January 1st of next year. Growmark officials have formed a selection committee and say that a transition process is underway and should be completed by November 30th. The Growmark board says it will consider candidates for the CEO position who have Growmark system experience. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Today we're talking with Audrey Erickson. She's the president of the Corn Refiners Association. We had discussed in great detail some of the high fructose sugar, but it's time to switch topics, Ms. Erickson, maybe to talk about some of the other products. Can you tell me what's made from corn and the kinds of exports that we have from the United States?
Well, we export about $1.5 billion worth of product. A lot of that has been animal feed products historically to the European Union, but biotech policies in the EU have not kept pace with technology in the United States, and biotechnology in particular in corn traits. So we've seen that those exports move to other countries. We also export a fair amount of corn oil and corn starch. And recently, exports of high fructose corn syrup to Mexico have regained momentum because we've resolved a long-standing NAFTA dispute.
And then if you can talk about the types of products that are in the pipeline now that might not be on the marketplace. Do you do research with the Corn Refiners Association too?
The research now is really done by our member companies. They're the ones that are competing in the marketplace, largely against each other, in fact, to bring the many products that and ingredients that make those products possible for consumers at highly affordable prices. So that research is really done, cutting-edge research, by our member companies directly as they're investing in new and innovative uses of corn.
Let's switch topics again. What's the position of the Refiners Association on the availability of corn to produce both fuel, food, feed, and all the types of things that corn is used for in the U.S. domestically and internationally?
Well, as you can imagine, we're strong supporters of all uses of corn, and believe that there's sufficient corn supply for those many uses. Clearly, as we increase yields of corn, that further enhances that situation that there's enough corn to go around. And, you know, we are an industry that uses corn to refine it into products for both food uses, clearly for fuel because our members do make ethanol from the wet milling process. But we make many of the ingredients that also go into pharmaceuticals, you know, whether it's an IV solution when someone's in the hospital or it's timed-release gel caps. You know, they find their start with corn. So we believe that there are many uses and will continue to be from the U.S. supply.
How did genetic modification of the corn plant cause the refiners' problems? And do you think there are still export issues that might come up? And I'm making some assumptions in the second part of the question.
Well, largely our issues in biotech, which, by the way, of course, we're very strong supporters of biotechnology and applaud new traits that are being introduced annually by the many seed tech providers. But when it comes to biotech, the biggest challenge we've really had is with the European Union because, as you know, they have been slow and often reluctant to accept the technology for political reasons. And politics trumps science when it comes to European Union and their agricultural and food policies. So as a result, we have seen a dramatic drop-off of exports of our corn gluten feed. So here as a nation, we don't export corn to the European Union because of their biotech policies, but we have been exporting corn gluten feed even during periods when corn wasn't exported because Europe is, you know, a region of the world that grows a lot of livestock, needs the protein to foster that livestock production, and corn gluten feed is clearly one of the highest quality protein-containing feed options available. But because so many new traits were being introduced in the United States, that affected our ability to export corn gluten feed to the European Union. Currently, all of the traits that have been introduced in the United States as single varieties, not the stack, but the single varieties are now approved for use in Europe, but by that I mean use presence in foods and stuff, not necessarily cultivation. As a result, we expect our corn gluten feed exports to increase somewhat for a short period of time until new traits are commercially available in the U.S.
And finally, one final question. Many of the companies that participate in the Refiners Association, and I'm thinking of Tate & Lyle, which is the old Staley Company indicator, many of our folks will recall it as that name, have business units that are overseas, possibly in Eastern Europe and in some of those countries that have been absorbed into the European Union. Do you deal with the legislative and legal issues for them in the overseas marketplace, too, from the standpoint of domestic corn production in a foreign country and how that would be taken? I may have confused the matter, but do you help them through legislative processes, for instance, for a corn grower, for corn production in Poland used domestically in Poland or into the European Union?
Really, all of our efforts have been focused here in the United States. In some cases, you'll find that in other parts of the world, there are starch associations, and Europe is a classic example where, for the European Union in particular, not necessarily Eastern Europe, but for the 25 member countries of the European Union, there is a starch association, and that association addresses primarily wheat starch. But clearly there's some corn starch involved, and we, work collaboratively and cooperatively to the extent that, you know, we can share information or the science or whatever we've done here, but we don't participate in legislative or other actions in other parts of the world because there tend to be, in many instances, associations already in existence addressing those needs.
Ms. Erickson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Audrey Erickson is the president of the Corn Refiners Association. We've been talking with her here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On behalf of Dave Dickey, I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.